Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the profits of cancer right after this. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment in our Constitution was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. Now, the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression from the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians, beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, more gun control. And you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. You know it and I know it. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. It doesn't come from our political process. It doesn't come from our politicians. It doesn't come from our lawyers or from our bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, you give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America now is in our courts. It's not in our politics. And if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, educational, informative, and free. And you can call and order one right now. That number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go straight to our webpage, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Click onto our archives page and download that free general law CD package right now. All right, we're reviewing a book here. It's called Murder by Injection. It's a book put out by Eustace Mullins back in 1988. And it's got 10 chapters in here, 10 subjects. And we covered the first one here, the medical monopoly, to give you an introduction to the American Medical Association. And I mentioned a fellow by the name of Bruce Halstead in the last program, who is a cancer researcher. And I told you, I said, I reported to you, Bruce Halstead went to prison. Bruce Halstead was disbarred. He was he had his license taken away from him, his medical license, because he was an honest, straightforward medical researcher who said, "Hey, listen, we can whip this cancer thing here for the people." He did not understand the politics. He did not understand the profits of cancer. So let's take a look at the profits that are involved in this cancer. In 400 BC, Hippocrates assigned the name of cancer, or crab, to a disease encountered during his time because of its crab-like spread through the human body. Its Greek name was carcinos, K-A-R-K-I-N-O-S, carcinos. In 164 AD, the physician Galen in Rome used the name of tumor, T-U-M-O-U-R, to describe this disease, from the Greek timbos, meaning a sepulchral mound, and the Latin tumor, T-U-M-O-R-E, to swell. The disease could not have been very prevalent. It is not mentioned in the Bible, nor is it included in the ancient medical book of China, the Yellow Emperor's classic of internal medicine. Unknown in most traditional societies, it spread with the rise of the Industrial Revolution. And in the 1830s, cancer was responsible for 2% of deaths in and around Paris. Cancer caused 4% of deaths in the United States in 1900. Now, with the rise of cancer came modern methods of coping with it. A leading critic of the medical establishment, Dr. Robert S. Mendelsohn, commented that modern cancer surgery someday will be regarded with the same kind of horror that we now regard the use of leeches in George Washington's day. The surgery of which he spoke is the widely accepted and imposed method of cancer treatment now in vogue throughout the United States. It's called cut, slash, and burn. Now, this method of cancer treatment actually represents the high water mark of the German allopathic school of medicine here in the United States. It relies almost exclusively on surgery, bleeding, and the heavy use of drugs. With the exotic addition of radium treatment, the temple of the modern method of cancer treatment in the United States is the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York City. Its high priests are the surgeons and researchers at this cancer center. Now, originally known as Memorial Hospital, this cancer establishment was presided over during its early years by two physicians who were stereotypes of the Hollywood caricatures of the mad doctor. If Hollywood planned to make a movie about this hospital, they would be stymied by the fact that only the late Bela Lugosi would be appropriate to play not one, but both of these two doctors. The first of these mad doctors was a fellow by the name of Dr. J. Marion Sims. Sims was the son of a South Carolina sheriff and tavern owner. Sims, born in 1813, died in 1883, was a 19th century woman's doctor. For years, he dabbled in experimental surgery by performing experiments on slave women in the South. According to his biographer, these operations were little short of murderous. When plantation owners refused to allow him to conduct further experiments on their slaves, he was forced to purchase a 17-year-old slave girl for $500. Within a few months, he had performed some 30 operations on this unfortunate young girl named Arcacha. Because there was no anesthesia at that time, he had to ask friends to hold Arcacha down while he performed his surgery upon her. After one or two such experiences, they usually refused to have anything further to do with him. He continued to experiment on Arcacha for 4 years, and in 1853 he decided to move to New York City. Now, whether his little Negro hospital in South Carolina was surrounded by screaming villagers one night as they brandished torches, as in the old Frankenstein movie, we don't know. However, his decision to move seems to have come rather suddenly. Dr. Sims bought a house on Madison Avenue where he found a supporter in the heiress of the Phelps Empire. Her name? Mrs. Melissa Phelps Dodge. This family has continued to be prominent supporters of the present cancer center, With her financial assistance, Sims founded Woman's Hospital, a 30-bed all-charity hospital which opened on May 1, 1855. Like a later quack, Doc Sims advertised himself as a woman's specialist, particularly in vesico-vaginal fistula, an abnormal passage between the bladder and the vagina. It is now known that this condition has always been iatrogenic, that is, it's caused by the doctor. It's caused by the ministrations of the doctors. In the 1870s, Sims began to specialize in the treatment of cancer. Rumors began to circulate in New York of barbarous operations being performed at Woman's Hospital. The mad doctor was at it again. The trustees of the institution reported that the lives of all of the patients were being threatened by mysterious experiments. Dr. Sims was fired from Woman's Hospital. However, because of his powerful financial supporters, he was soon reinstated. He was then contacted by members of the Astor family, whose fortune was founded on old John Jacob Astor's ties with the British East India Company, the British Secret Intelligence Service, and the international opium trade. One of the Astors had recently died of cancer, and the family wished to establish a cancer hospital in New York City. They first approached the trustees of Woman's Hospital with an offer of a donation of $150,000 if they would turn it into a cancer hospital. Smarting from his recent firing, Sims double-crossed the trustees by private negotiations with the Astors. He persuaded them to back him in a new hospital, which he called the New York Cancer Hospital. It opened in 1884. Dr. Sims later went to Paris, where he attended the Empress Eugenie, who was later awarded the Order of Leopold from the King of the Belgians. Apparently, he had lost none of his chutzpah. He returned to New York, where he died shortly before the opening of his new hospital. In the 1890s, after receiving gifts from other benefactors, the hospital was renamed Memorial Hospital. In the mid-20th century, the names of Sloan and Kettering were added. Despite these names, this cancer center has for many years been a major appendage of the Rockefeller medical monopoly. During the 1930s, a block of land on the fashionable Upper East Side was donated by the Rockefellers to build its new building. Rockefeller henchmen have dominated the board of directors ever since the building was opened. In 1913, a group of doctors and a layman met in May at the Harvard Club in New York City to establish a national cancer organization. Not unnaturally, it was named the American Society for the Control of Cancer. Note that it was not called a Society for the Cure of Cancer, or a Society for the Prevention of Cancer, and nor have these ever been the primary goals of the cancer organization. 1913, of course, was a very significant year in American history. It was during that fateful year that President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act, which was set up to provide funding for the forthcoming First World War. A national progressive income tax was introduced directly from Karl Marx's Manifesto of 1848. That was imposed upon the American people. The legislatures had their constitutional duty of appointing senators removed, they being henceforth elected by popular vote. They all now had to compete for the popular vote, and it was in this heady era of socialist planning and experimentation that the Cancer Society originated. Naturally enough, it was funded by John D. Rockefeller. His attorneys, D.B. Voice and Plimpton, remained dominant in the administration of the new society throughout the 1920s. Its funding came from the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Foundation and from J.P. Morgan. From its very inception, the American Cancer Society has followed the pattern set up by the American Medical Association. The American Cancer Society also had a board of trustees, a house of delegates, and in the 1950s, it also established a committee on quackery. This committee later changed its name to the Committee on Unproven Methods of Cancer Management. Noted that it was never called cure. It's always been called management. But the society still used the term quackery freely in referring to any methods not sanctioned by its trustees or deviating from the cut, burn, and poison method of cancer treatment. In 1909, the railroad magnate E. H. Harriman, whose fortune, like that of the Rockefellers, had been funded entirely with Rothschild money, funneled to him by Jacob Schiff of the Kuhn Loeb Company, died of cancer. So now, with E. H. Harriman dying of cancer, his family then formed the Harriman Research Institute. In 1917, this scion of the family, W. Averill Harriman, abruptly decided to go into politics, or rather to manage our political parties from behind the scenes. The Institute was suddenly shut down. Its financial backing was then transferred to Memorial Hospital. The principal backer of the hospital at that time was James Douglas. James Douglas, born in 1837, died in 1918. He was the chairman of the Phelps Dodge Corporation, whose heiress in 1853, remember, Melissa Phelps Dodge, had been the initial backer of what eventually became Memorial Hospital. Well, Melissa Phelps Dodge had married a dry goods merchant named William Dodge, who used the Phelps fortune to become a giant in the copper production and mining industry. The Dictionary of National Biography describes James Douglas as the Dean of Mining and Metallurgical Properties. He owned the richest copper mine in the world, the Copper Queen Lode. He was born in Canada. He was the son of Dr. James Douglas, a surgeon who became head of the Quebec Lunatic Asylum. His son joined the Phelps Dodge Company in 1910, later becoming its chairman, because he had discovered extensive pitch blende deposits on his western mining properties. He became fascinated with radium. In collaboration with the Bureau of Mines, a government agency which he, for all practical purposes, controlled, he founded the National Radium Institute. His personal physician was Dr. James Ewing. Ewing, born in 1866, died in 1943. Douglas offered to give Memorial Hospital $100,000, but there were several conditions. One of the conditions was that the hospital must hire Dr. Ewing as its chief pathologist. And the second condition was that the hospital must commit itself to treating nothing but cancer, and that it would routinely use radium in its cancer treatments. The hospital accepted these conditions, not because radium had ever been proven to be effective in treating cancer, but because there was a $100,000 grant that went with it. That's how cancer treatment with radium got its start. Now, with Douglas's money behind him, Ewing soon became head of the entire hospital. Douglas was so convinced of the benefits of radium therapy that he used it frequently on his daughter, who was then dying of cancer, on his wife, and on himself, exposing his family to radium therapy for the most trivial ailments. Because of Douglas's prominence, the New York Times gave a great deal of publicity to this new radium treatment for cancer. The journalist headlined his story with the page one headline. It said, "Radium Cure Free for All." The claim was made that not 1 cent's worth of radium will be for sale. Douglas was greatly annoyed by this statement, and on October the 24th, 1913, he had the Times run a correction. He was quoted as follows, "All this story about humanity and philanthropy is foolish. I want it understood that I shall do what I like with the radium that belongs to me." This was a rare glimpse of the true nature of this philanthropist. His rivals in this field, Rockefeller and Carnegie, always gave away their money with no strings attached. With this assurance, they were able to stealthily establish their secret power over the nation. Douglas had revealed the true nature of his philanthropy. Now, the original press releases from Memorial Hospital had, in fact, intimated that the radium treatments would be free. They apparently believed that the great philanthropist, James Douglas, would donate his supply. The Memorial Hospital rules and regulations were immediately changed to stipulate that an extra charge would be made for radium emanations used in the treatment of patients. In 1924, the radium department at Memorial Hospital gave $18,000 radium treatments to patients, for which it charged $70,000, its largest single source of income for that year. Meanwhile, James Douglas, who had boasted that he would do what he liked with his radium, continued to give himself frequent treatments. A few weeks after the New York Times story, in 1913, Douglas died of aplastic anemia. Medical authorities now believe that he was but one of a number of personalities associated with the early development of radium who died from its effects, the most famous being Marie Curie, wife of its discoverer, and her daughter, Irene. By 1922, more than 100 radiologists had died from X-ray-produced cancer. Douglas's protege, Dr. Ewing, remained at Memorial Hospital several more years. He developed a number of ailments, the most annoying being tic douloureux, which made it embarrassing for him to meet or talk with anyone. He withdrew from the hospital, becoming a recluse on Long Island, where he finally died of cancer of the bladder in 1943. Douglas's son and heir, Lewis Douglas, inherited one of the largest American fortunes at that time. He married Peggy Zinser, daughter of a partner of J.P. Morgan Company. Peggy's two sisters also married well. One married John J. McCloy, who became the chief lawyer for the Rockefeller interests. The other married Konrad Adenauer, who became chancellor of post-war Germany. Lewis Douglas became chairman of Mutual Life of New York, a Morgan-controlled company. And early in World War II, he became a protege of W. Averill Harriman in the Lend-Lease administration. Douglas was then named chairman of the War Shipping Board, one of the famous dollar-a-year men of the Roosevelt administration. Later in the year, he succeeded Harriman as U.S. ambassador to England. After Hitler's fall, Douglas was slated to become High Commissioner of Germany, but he stepped aside to allow his brother-in-law, John J. McCloy, to take his post. Now, the two Americans were pleasantly surprised when their brother-in-law, Konrad Adenauer, was named Chancellor of West Germany. The family interests of the J.P. Morgan Company were firmly in control. In fact, Adenauer's earlier political activities in wartime Germany had centered around a small group of J.P. Morgan cohorts in Germany, and they were ready to take over when Hitler died. In the 1930s, two giants of the automotive industry were persuaded to become contributors to Memorial Hospital. Alfred P. Sloan had been president of General Motors for a number of years. He was also a director of J.P. Morgan Company. In 1938, he owned 750,000 shares of General Motors stock. He owned a 235-foot yacht, which was valued at $1.25 million in 1940. Charles Kettering was an authentic inventive genius. He was responsible for much of today's auto ignition, lights, starters, and other electrical systems found on automobiles routinely today. His fortune was estimated in 1960, that was Alfred Sloan's 1960, net worth $200 to $400 million, while Kettering was worth about $100 to $200 million. So let me cover that one for you one more time so you get the numbers straight. Alfred Sloan had a net worth of about $200 to $400 million, and Kettering had about half that, about $100 to $200 million, as of 1960. Now, Alfred Sloan's credentials as a philanthropist were somewhat marred by his record at General Motors. Sloan had steadfastly opposed the installation of safety glass in Chevrolet automobiles. During the 1920s, the lack of safety glass meant that a relatively minor auto accident, if it caused the breaking of the windshield or the windows of a car, could result in hideous disfigurement or death for the occupants. Shards of flying glass would rip through the interior, slicing the passengers as it tore by. For a relatively minor amount, the ordinary glass used in automobiles during that period could be replaced with safety glass. Now, today, safety glass is required in all automobiles. Sloan made a public statement on this issue on August 13, 1929. He said, "The advent of safety glass will result in both ourselves and our company absorbing a very considerable portion of the extra cost out of our profits. I feel that General Motors should not adopt safety glass for its cars and raise its prices even a part of what that extra cost should be." On August 15, 1932, Sloan again reiterated his opposition to the installation of safety glass in General Motors automobiles. He said, "It's not my responsibility to sell safety glass." And he complained, "I would very much rather spend the same amount of money on improving our car in other ways because I think, from the standpoint of selfish business, it would be a very much better investment." Now, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation is doing well. In 1975, it had $252 million, which grew to $370 million by 1985. That and the Charles F. Kettering Foundation, $75 million, continued to be the chief benefactors of the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. A liberal editor, Norman Cousins, heads the Kettering Foundation. The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation is headed by R. Manning Brown, Jr. Directors include Henry H. Fowler, former Secretary of the Treasury, now a partner of Goldman Sachs on Wall Street. The New York investment bankers. Also director is Lloyd C. Elam, president of the nation's only black medical school called McCary College in Nashville, Tennessee. Elam is also a director of the giant Merck medical firm, Merck, the pharmaceutical company. Kraft, South Central Bell Telephone, and the Nashville Bank. Franklin A. Long represents the necessary Rockefeller connection as a director of Exxon. He is also director of United Technologies, Presidential Science Advisory Commission, professor of chemistry at Cornell since 1936, a Guggenheim Fellow. He has received the Albert Einstein Peace Prize. He is a member of the American Pugwash Steering Committee, set up by the notoriously pro-communist financier Cyrus Eaton, who was a Rockefeller protege. Pugwash is said to be directed by the KGB of the Soviet Union. Herbert E. Longenecker, president of Tulane University. Longenecker serves on the selection committee for Fulbright students, a very powerful position. His list of awards and honors in Who's Who goes on for several paragraphs. Then there's Kathleen Morowitz, who is a director of National Cash Register, also a Guggenheim Fellow. She's married to Herbert Morowitz, a chemist from Prague. Thomas Aquinas Murphy, president of General Motors for many years, also director of PepsiCo and the National Detroit Corporation. Elmore E. Patterson, who had been with J.P. Morgan Company since 1935, he also serves as treasurer of Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and is director of Bethlehem Steel, Engelhart Hanovia, and Morgan Stanley. Lawrence S. Rockefeller, who is director of Reader's Digest, National Geographic Society, and the Keneal Bay Plantation. Charles J. Scanlon, director of the General Motors Acceptance Corporation, Arab American Bank of New York, and trustee of Roosevelt Hospital of New York, and Harold T. Shapiro, president of the University of Michigan, director of the Dow Chemical Corporation and the Ford Motor Company. Burroughs, Kellogg, and the Bank of Canada. Shapiro has been on the advisory panel of the Central Intelligence Agency since 1984, and he's also an advisor to the United States Treasury Department. I want you to notice here, parenthetically, that all of these interlocking boards of directors, these foundations, notice how they're all connected. They're connected with the Rockefellers. They're connected with the moneyed financial powers of the United States, who got their money and their start in life from the Rothschilds of France, Germany, and England. I mean, all we're dealing with here, boys and girls, is one big, happy family. These people are in control. These people control the philanthropies. They control the medicine. They control finance, pharmaceuticals, automotives, industry. I mean, there isn't anything in America that these people don't control. If they don't own it, you can damn well bet they control it. Hey, we're at the halfway point. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Cordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. And it has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate by endorsing and recommending the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or even ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a section of the book, Murder by Injection, called The Prophets of Cancer. I mentioned to you last time that this book, I thought, was misnamed. I don't want to name the book for the author. His name is Eustace Mullins, but this book goes so much further than the title, Murder by Injection. It leaves me with the impression, when I picked the book up back in 1988 or 9 when I first read it, I thought, oh, this is going to be a book on health that deals with vaccinations or deals with inoculations, or it's dealing, you know, with something along that line. It's got one chapter in here that deals with vaccination. That's an important chapter, but this chapter here, dealing with cancer, the prophets of cancer, you know, many, many books have been written on the subject of cancer. Not just the curing of cancer, but the political intrigues that go with it. And I mentioned Bruce Halstead in the last program. I said, hey, Maureen Salomon was the lady of the National Institutes of Health, NIH, I believe it was, NIH. Maureen Salomon. I'm going to write her name down here. Maureen. M-A-U-R-E-E-N. Maureen Salomon. Approached me and she said, is there anything we can do with this Bruce Halstead case? And I said, no. No. See, Halstead was a licensed medical doctor who went against the establishment. And they just wiped him out. I had that happen to me once. A fellow by the name of Denny Salaz. He was the head of the Bar Association in Boise, Idaho. One day, he came out, and I was walking down a street, or I'd been into the into their office. I've forgotten exactly how it came up. But anyway, Denny came out. He always reminded me of that guy sucking on a lollipop. He's bald-headed, you know. Was that guy's name? Again, that Greek actor with a lollipop in his mouth. Kojak. Kojak. That's who he reminded me of. Anyway, Denny came out of his office. Came out. So, Pat, he met me out on the sidewalk. And he said, Gordon, he said, come on in here. Let's talk. I said, we want to talk about Denny. And he said, listen, it's time for you to join the Bar Association. God, what an honor. Here comes the president of the Idaho Bar Association, and he says, it's time for you to join the Bar Association. And I said, well, why, Denny? And he said, that's where the money's at. He told me flat out, that's where the money's at. He said, now, you are very talented. There isn't any reason why you can't pass the bar exam. And then you can come in here and open an office and practice law like all the rest of us. Now, I'd already been informed by my mentor, Ben Rice, that law was a sleazy business. Hell, I knew that by that time. But here's the difference. See, I'm not licensed. I'm not bonded. I'm not insured. You can't disbar me. That's the beauty of being a pro se litigant. You can't disbar me. Ben Rice told me, he said, I can't go into court and do what you can do as a pro se litigant, because if I did, I'd be disbarred. So what Denny was after, hey, join our club so that we can control you, and if we don't control you, we'll disbar you. And if you get lippy with us, we'll throw you in prison like this guy, Bruce Halstead. See, you medical doctors out there, they got you people by the short hairs. You don't dare go against medical orthodoxy. Now, 90% of pediatricians do not vaccinate their own children. We learned that from Robert Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn, remember, was a teaching doctor, a professor, at a teaching hospital, teaching doctors. He wrote a number of books. If you can get any of Mendelsohn's books, they're all good, every one of them. He never wrote a bad line in a bad book. He never wrote a bad chapter in a poor book or a bad line in any of the above. Robert Mendelsohn. Just go into any health food store and just tell them, hey, give me the Mendelsohn books. And they should have them all right there on their bookshelf. Now, Mendelsohn was an insider. He died in his early 60s. I suspect he was murdered. That's just me. You know, hell, he just like any of these other guys over here, you know, you do business with the Clintons and you may have a short lifespan. Doing business with the mafia isn't the surest way of reaching 70 years of age. But anyway, Mendelsohn gives a lot of information on the inside workings of the medical monopoly. And Eustace Mullins has picked up right on Mendelsohn's work, and he's used a lot of Mendelsohn's work here in his own book. And he cited Mendelsohn a number of times. And so that'll give you a little more inside information. Oftentimes, you know, people get evangelistic zeal, and they want to go out and help people, and they want to give money to the Cancer Society, or they want to, if they're a doctor, you know, they want to go out and heal people and one thing and another. That's just a pipe dream. That isn't going to happen out here in the real world. And that's where murder by injection shines, because Eustace Mullins is pointing out, hey, listen, wait a minute. These people haven't spent millions and millions and billions of dollars and decades and even centuries of time creating this monstrosity called the AMA, called the medical monopoly, to have you nitwits and fools and dumb blondes come over here and start healing people free of charge, or to come up with a cure to cancer. This is a $500 billion a year industry. I'm telling you, this is one of the biggest money makers in the history of the world. Only war makes more money than medicine. And war is kind of sporadic. But here in the United States, to give you an illustration, our defense budget's about $500 billion a year. Just one portion, just one branch of medicine makes that much. $500 billion a year. That's why the government's out here to take over the medical monopoly. The government wants into this. They want to control this from the bureaucracy's point of view. Now, I suspect that the Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Foundation, Sloan Kettering, Foundations and Hospital, and the American Cancer Society and the Pharmaceutical Trust and the Rockefeller Trust, and so I suspect they're all in on the game. We're going to get national health care insurance. Bet on it. Now, for those of us that don't want to participate in this program over here, you know, there's always a few iconoclasts out here. I mentioned 12% of them to you in our program last week. We're talking about the swine flu vaccine. Now, in this chapter, this chapter here is called The Profits of Cancer. And this is a god-awful good business. If you'd like a copy of the book, it's called Murder by Injection, The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America. Fits right into Bible prophecy, by the way. We're right on the cusp of the Great Tribulation. If we're not in it yet, we're getting real close. And these people have a great part to play in this Great Tribulation drama that's going to be played out in the book of Revelation as we come to this 3.5 year, this 1260-day period of death and destruction on a scale that can only be described in biblical terms. Okay, the author now is Eustace Mullins. You spell his name E-U-S-T-A-C-E. M-U-L-L-I-N-S, Eustace Mullins, Murder by Injection. So if you take that into, say, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, I don't know if you can get this book. It's been banned by the National Association, is that what they call it? The National Association of Libraries in the United States. I mean, they banned it. They read his book and they say, oh my God, this guy's opposed to Rockefeller. This guy's opposed to vaccinations. This guy's opposed to the American Medical Association. So we're opposed to his book and we will not put it in the library. I'll bet you will not find this book in any library in the United States of America, any public library. I guarantee you ain't going to find it in any Carnegie Library. Now, the book is out there, and it's available. Now, if you can't find it in any of those locations, listen. We have a source for books. And there's a bookstore in Austin, Texas, and it's called BraveNewBookstore.com. These guys have the book. If they ain't got it, they'll get it. This is the source for every underground book that's ever been printed. This is the place to go. Brave New Bookstore. They're located at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, last time I heard. Austin, Texas, 78705. They got a phone number. Jot it down. Don't lose it. The number is 512-480-2503. Now remember, we're in Austin, Texas here. The area code 512-480-2503, BraveNewBookstore.com, Austin, Texas. If you can't find a book anyplace else, you hear me mention a book or you hear me mention some thingy over here, you can't find it anywhere. You can't find it on the internet. You can't find it with Barnes & Noble. You can't find it with Amazon. You can't get it from your local bookstore. You call this guy right there. In fact, you could probably save yourself a lot of time if you just went to BraveNewBookstore.com for openers, especially on what you hear here, because much of the material that I use here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review are banned books. This is the kind of stuff you ain't supposed to read, kids. You're not supposed to hear this. All right, Eustace Mullins is his name, Murder by Injection. We're on Profits of Cancer. Listen to this. The governing board of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute, called the Board of Managers, reads like a financial statement of the various Rockefeller holdings. Its principal director for many years was the late Louis Strauss. Louis Strauss, partner of Kuhn Loeb Company, right off of Wall Street. The Rothschild bankers in the United States, Kuhn Loeb, that's the Rothschild bank in the United States. Strauss listed himself in Who's Who as financial advisor to Mr. Rockefeller's. He was also a director of Studebaker, Polaroid, NBC, RCA, and held government posts as Secretary of Commerce and head of the Atomic Energy Commission. For many years, he funneled Rockefeller funds into the notorious Communist Front, the Institute of Pacific Relations. Strauss was also president of the Institute for Advanced Study, a Rockefeller think tank at Princeton, and financial director of the American Jewish Committee, for which he raised the funds to publish the propaganda organ Commentary Magazine. All right, Louis Strauss. See, when I said earlier before the break, I said, hey, listen, we're just talking about one big happy family here. One big happy family. These guys control the whole kahuna. And like I said, now if they don't own it directly, you know, all you need in a corporation is 5% of its stock to control it. Because after all, you're going to vote, and it's 5%. 5%. You own 5%, and you got that big a vote in Polaroid, you're going to control the Polaroid Corporation. Now, another prominent director of Sloan Kettering was Dorothy Peabody Davison, a leading New York socialite for some 50 years. She had married F. Truby Davidson, son of Henry Pomeroy Davidson, a Rockefeller relative who had been the right-hand man for J.P. Morgan. Davison was one of the group of five leading bankers who met with Senator Nelson Aldrich. His daughter married John D. Rockefeller, Jr., at Jekyll Island in a secret conference to draft the Federal Reserve Act in November of 1910. Now, the directory, or the dictionary, of National Biography notes that Davison soon won recognition from J.P. Morgan, frequently consulting with him, particularly during the monetary crisis of 1907. In association with Senator Aldrich, Paul M. Warburg, Frank A. Vanderlip, and A. Piatt Andrew, he took part in drawing up the Jekyll Island report that led to the crystallization of sentiment resulting in the creation of the Federal Reserve System. As head of the Red Cross War Council during the First World War, Davidson raised $370 million, of which a considerable number of millions were diverted to Russia to salvage the floundering Bolshevik Revolution. His son and namesake, Henry P. Davison, married Ann Stillman, daughter of James Stillman, head of the National City Bank, which handled the enormous cash flow accruing to the Standard Oil Company. H.P. also became a partner of J.P. Morgan Company. His brother, F. Truby Davidson, married Dorothy Peabody, the nation's leading philanthropic family. The Peabodys may be said to have invented the concept of foundation philanthropy, the first major foundation being the Peabody Education Fund, set up in 1865 by George Peabody, the founder of the J.P. Morgan banking firm. It later became the Rockefeller Foundation. Dorothy Peabody's father was the renowned Endicott Peabody, founder of the establishment training school, Groton, where Franklin D. Roosevelt and many other front men in politics have been educated. Dorothy Peabody was on the national board of the American Cancer Society for many years, as well as director of the Sloan Kettering Foundation. She was also a noted big game hunter, making many forays in India and Africa, and winning many trophies for her prize animals. Her husband was Secretary of War for Air from 1926 to 1932, and was president of the American Museum of Natural History for many years. This was Teddy Roosevelt's favorite charity. Well, her son, Endicott Peabody Davison, became secretary to the J.P. Morgan Company and then general manager of the London branch of the firm. He has been president of U.S. Trust since 1979. Director of the defense firm Scovell Corporation and Todd Shipyards. Also, the Discount Corporation. He is a trustee of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Markle Foundation, which makes key grants to the communications media. Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, was also related to the Rockefellers through the Pomeroy family. Now, the present board of managers of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center include Edward J. Beatty, a Markle scholar at George Washington University and staff member of Rockefeller Hospital since 1978, fellow of the American Cancer Society and chief medical officer of Memorial Hospital since 1965, Peter O. Crisp, who is manager of investments for the Rockefeller Family Associates, Harold Fisher, chairman of Exxon Corporation, the flag bearer of the Rockefeller fortune, Clifton C. Garvin, Jr., president of Exxon Corporation, director of Citicorp, Citibank, the former National Citibank, PepsiCo, JCPenney, TRW, Equitable Life, Corning Glass, and the drug firm Johnson & Johnson. See, boys and girls, it's just one big happy family. Louis V. Gerstner, Jr., president of the Giant Squib drug firm, director of American Express, Caterpillar, and Melville Corporation. He's a member of the visiting committee at Harvard University, Elmore C. Patterson with J.P. Morgan since 1935. Well, he married Anne Hyde Choate of New York's leading legal family. Patterson is treasurer of Memorial Sloan Kettering. He is also a trustee of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which was formerly headed by Alger Hiss. Patterson's brother-in-law, Arthur H. Choate, Jr., was a partner of J.P. Morgan Company for some years. He then joined Clark, Dodge & Company. Robert V. Roussa, partner of the investment bankers Brown Brothers Harriman, a Rhodes Scholar who was the mastermind of the Federal Reserve System for many years, training such heads of the Federal Reserve as Paul Volcker, and then nominating him to be chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors in Washington. Roussa also helped David Rockefeller set up the Trilateral Commission, of which he remains a director. Benno C. Schmidt, managing partner of the investment bankers of J.H. Whitney Company for many years, which has large holdings in Schulenberger, Freeport Minerals, and CBS. Take a look at communications. Take a look at the media. The media comes in here and acts as a front runner to promote all of this cancer, politics, economics, Wall Street bailout at taxpayers' expense. These guys are all laughing up their sleeves as they loot the American treasury, as they rape, rob, and pillage and run roughshod over the entire political, economic, and medical establishment. God, what a party. What a blowout this has been for all of them. It's coming to an end. That's the good news. It's coming to an end. The bad news is it's going to be god-awful. And it's going to affect all of us, whether we like it or not. Well, I'm running out of time here. Kids, we're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and the editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.